Accession number 29424, reel number 4.
Yeah.
You know, covering territory like that in Namibia.
Yeah.
Well, Namibia we call it now, but as you say.
That's right, it was just still South African territory. And there I actually spent my time with a liberal rabbi telling me, you know, a lot about the situation. He wasn't all that liberal. I mean, he was also trying to defend the system, but it was very interesting. The first Jewish person I'd met and who I spent quite a lot of time with and giving me his version of the local situation. So that was an important visit to South Africa. But perhaps even more important was my involvement at the end of apartheid. When
Before you tell me that, could I just ask you this question, Paul? I know the anti-apartheid movement were very for sanctions and cutting off South Africa. You know, people going there, businesses going there, musicians like Donald Swan, for instance, performing there. And your philosophy, as you've explained with Eastern Europe, is very much for contact and going. Did you feel the same with South Africa as you did with Eastern Europe?
I totally supported, as the churches did, the campaign for an economic boycott of South Africa. Because I thought it would be effective, and indeed it was. But I also said this should not include what I would call intellectual and cultural exchange. Boycotting South African universities, boycotting South African artistic events. I think I did support the sports boycott. People like David Sheppard refused to play cricket in South Africa. I did support that. But I did feel that the exchange of ideas would undermine apartheid more than not doing that. So I made that distinction. But trade and sport, yes. Other things, no. was my compromised version of what I felt about South Africa. But towards, and of course, you did ask the question: who were the key figures in South Africa? Well, the great Roman Catholic Archbishop Hurley, who right through his time was a great fighter for African equality, and not enough recognized by the world. Alongside him, the Anglican Bishop of Johannesburg, who was expelled by the South African government. His name's just gone for the moment.
Not to worry, because this can easily be put in.
Yeah. I mean, there were a whole series of Anglican bishops who really made me proud to be an Anglican. There was the Archbishop I supported as a young priest. You know, I told you this. All these names suddenly go when you need them. But there were a whole range of Anglican bishops. And, of course, there was the great Trevor Huddleston, who was recalled back to England by the Murfield Fathers, because I don't think they could quite face his radical opposition. And there's no doubt at all that if they hadn't recalled him as a member of the Murfield Brotherhood, he would have been expelled anyway. He was, and his book, Cry the Beloved Country, Naught for Your Comfort, Naught for Your Comfort, was his great book. Cry the Beloved Country was a novel by, was also a great book, but and a film. I've forgotten the author. The author was a liberal South African, but Naught for Your Comfort was immensely influential on me too at that early stage, because Trevor Huddleston was still in on the beginnings of the struggle. Yes, Ambrose Reeves was the bishop of Johannesburg, who was expelled back to Britain. And Joost de Blanc was the Archbishop of Cape Town, whom I had supported. These were all important in the struggle, but probably the most important person beside Archbishop Hurley was Beyers Naudé, this great prophet of this great Afrikaner, who was a traitor, as they regarded, to his own people, who turned anti-apartheid and founded the Christian Institute, which was an anti-apartheid organization, when really the Dutch Reformed Church solidly supported apartheid. And Beyers Naudé came from a pioneer Dutch Reformed family, one of the top families, in America, like the women who were the mothers of the revolution, who came from the first families of revolutionary America. Well, this was one of the great families that had fought in the Boer War against the British, and he turned traitor. He died last year. I mean, his wonderful biography that I've just read. And so, these were great figures in the anti-apartheid struggle, and I knew them all personally well. And of course, very late on the scene, only in the last decade of the anti-apartheid struggle, comes this clown, this cheeky little priest called Tutu, whom the whites thought was just too cheeky for words. Who does he think he is? Who made his way from being just a simple Anglican priest working for the World Council of Churches in London, where I got to know him as a totally unknown person, to being by far the most famous Anglican bishop that there ever has been in history, and second to Mandela, who's regarded as one of the great fathers of the revolution. Well, towards the end of the struggle, knowing Desmond as I did, he said, "You must come out to South Africa." And by this time, of course, the liberal wind was blowing. This was around the time when Mandela was released, and when the great problem was there going to be a civil war between the blacks? Because Buthelezi, the chieftain of the Zulus, wanted to create a Zulu kingdom of his own, opposed to the ANC. And he was Margaret Thatcher's hero. He was the good black, opposing the ANC, but playing his own political game in KwaZulu, and wanting to turn the province of Natal into a separate state, which was then a sort of a Bantustan, and he was its president. But as chance had it, he was a friend of mine. A very extraordinary chance that about 12 years earlier, or more than that, my bishop in Southwark rang me up and said, "A young Zulu chief is coming to London, and he wants to get some money to start a Zulu newspaper. And he's an Anglican. And he's written to the church asking us to sponsor him and put him up. Will you put him up in our diocesan conference house, of which I was chaplain?" So a chap called Gacha Buthelezi arrived on my doorstep. And for a fortnight, he was my guest. And it was rather charming. But he then proved to be the great Buthelezi, the great Mangazuthu Buthelezi, who was head of Inkatha, the movement opposing the ANC, with killing going on between blacks constantly. And he was the chieftain on the one side and the ANC was on the other. And I was asked to go and visit Buthelezi and see if I could persuade him that it was in his own interest not to form his little kingdom, but to come in and be part of the ANC government and stop a potential civil war. And so I went out to see Buthelezi. He picked me up in his personal plane, flew me to his little kingdom and to his headquarters in... he had a little palace of his own. Got the government of KwaZulu, yeah, in the capital of KwaZulu, and in all, I went on two visits to him, with about 9 months in between. Each time, joining those bringing pressure on him to stop this mad secessionist war and see that he would be in the end be the loser if he did this, and that he should come in an all black South African government. And in the end he did, but it took a lot of pressure. And of course, again, I was just one cog in the machinery and the pressures brought on him from around the world. But it was a great privilege to be able to do that. And because he liked me, and I confess to even liking him as a person, and thinking he was a very foolish person, and a very vain person, but rather charming and well-meaning, with some rather nasty people behind him, goading him on. So I felt some of his kitchen cabinet, one or two of whom I knew, and they were white usually, were really nasty types. I wouldn't class him as nasty, I'd call him just rather vain and not very bright. So that was my contribution to the new South Africa. I never met Mandela in all this. And I think half the world seems to have met Mandela somewhere, but I haven't.
Plenty of time.
That
must have been, you know, a very important thing to have averted a black civil war, which would have played into all sorts
Well,
of
exactly. Well, to have helped avert it, you know, I would be mad if I thought I'd averted black civil war. But, you know, it took a lot of people working on it in different ways. I think the final sort of pressure on him was actually a Nigerian diplomat who came on behalf of the All Africa Conference, what's it called, African States, on behalf of all the African states, basically saying to him, if you do this, none of the African states will recognize you as a state. That was the kind of most powerful, I think, pressure. So, you know, I don't kid myself that my powers of persuasion did it. I was just, as I say, one cog in
as one never knows.
You do what you can, and you do never know. And
I suppose in your case it would have been publicised.
Absolutely no publicity. Absolutely no publicity. It was not most of the most significant things I've done. Did I in our previous interviews talk about my mission to the West German Baader-Meinhof terrorist group? Well, you see, that wasn't publicised.
Yes, well, we ought to hear about that at some time.
That was a major undertaking, to stop a hunger strike of the West German Baader-Meinhof terrorist group.
Oh, yes.
Whom I visited in West German prisons. And negotiated an agreement between the prisoners and the West German government. That was one of the most significant things I've done.
Is that a bigger story, do you think, to leave and...
It is a pretty big story, yes.
That. But, you know, obviously a very good example of your methods, isn't it, which works in
ways. Yeah. And that was done entirely as just me, which in a way, too, was my thing with Buthelezi. You know, I didn't do it on behalf of any organisation. The churches didn't send me to do it. Tutu rang me up and said, will you do it? You know, it was just a personal, on the personal network. And the German prisoner thing was of a very similar kind, that a person in Germany, who was actually the sister of one of the prisoners, was desperately looking for someone who might have the skills to, and might be acceptable both to the prisoners and to the government, to mediate between them. So it was a request from really a relative of the one of the prisoners that led to this whole operation. Completely personal. It had nothing to do with amnesty, because none of these prisoners were prisoners of conscience. They were all very violent people. So amnesty, it wasn't publicised. And in fact, it was very important that it shouldn't be, because it would have been bad to get amnesty mixed up in it, because it had nothing to do with amnesty.
It's very interesting, you know, that you are a pacifist and a great reconciler and a peacemaker, but you don't shy away from violence, do you, Paul? From violent people, if it means that the end is...
No, of course not. Of course not. I mean, I now quote my successor at Coventry Cathedral, Andrew White, who spends his time negotiating between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and the various bitter factions in Iraq. And he always says to me, "I don't waste my time talking to the liberal people. There are plenty of liberal Muslims. You can have a lovely time with them. And there are plenty of liberal Jews in Israel." And plenty of liberal Palestinians around the place. But they're not the problem. You can sit around the table and drink tea and coffee with them till the cows come home. It won't change anything. It's the nasty people I spend my time with. Well, he's in a rather more high profile and demonstrative way. I mean, he operates in ways that I don't. But, I mean, that's his message. I spend my time with the nasty people.
So, South Africa, were you there for the elections?
Nope. No, I wasn't there for any of the, what I would call the dramatic things. But by chance, I was there. You know, when apartheid was falling to bits, it was long before the elections. But I was there as a guest of Desmond Tutu, on the day the Berlin Wall came down. And I watched the Berlin Wall come down from Cape Town with apartheid crumbling around me. And I thought that was an extraordinary feeling. I went straight to Berlin from there to see it for myself.
Well, that's another story, because I think that's, you know, we'll work in with a lot of other topics.
Yeah.
And what do you think, have you been to South Africa
Since? No. No. No, I must confess that I'm sad about it, because I've got friends there, and it would have been nice to go. But I've been, you know, life has been busy, other things have, you know, I haven't needed to go there for any political reason.
Do you have any particular view of it, how the sort of post-apartheid system is working?
A bit better than the post-communist system in Russia, but it's still awful. It now has, I think nobody pretends otherwise, probably the greatest crime rate in the world. The years of oppression have left a demoralized, uneducated mass of young black people without work, and the South African government can't produce the magic that they need to change all that. And the ANC itself, like most organisations, can't escape from corruption within it. And so the post-Mandela leadership is not exactly impressive. AIDS is rampant, and they do for a long time they did nothing about it and denied it. So it's not a happy place. Maybe that's one of the reasons I'm not very keen to go. Because I don't want to spend my time visiting rich white people still living behind fences and pretending nothing's changed, because you can if you've got the money and the servants and all the rest. You can still live the way they did in apartheid times, and many do. And to go and see the misery still in the townships, when at the age of 75, I don't kid myself that I can do much about it. It's not my favourite idea. So I think I'm not surprised that I haven't been back.